stress rhythm in poetry and prose. This investigation and discussion grew out of a workshop on rhythm in language I gave in 1995. It leads to the next essay on rhythm in Tolkien's work. Getting the beat. From the Concise Oxford Dictionary. Rhythm. Physics, physiology, etc. Movement with regular succession of strong and weak elements, regularly recurring sequence of events. In literature, metrical movement determined by various relations of long and short or accented and unaccented syllables, measured flow of words and phrases in verse or prose. In music, periodical accent and the duration of notes. In fine arts, harmonious correlation of parts, regular succession of opposites. Movement is the first word. Rhythm is a mode of time. Like time, rhythm can be imagined as linear, events seen as beads strung along a line of intervals, or cyclical, the line becomes a circle, a necklace of beads. Or if the event is singular, the interval can be seen as a circle always coming round to it again, for instance, year as interval, birthday as event. Identical intervals make a regular rhythm. The more irregular the intervals are, the more alike the events have to be for any rhythm to be recognized. Rhythm is a physical, material, bodily thing. The drumstick hitting the drumhead, the dancers pounding feet. Rhythm is a spiritual thing. The drummer's ecstasy, the dancer's joy. Beginning to consider the rhythms of writing, my mind wandered about among the world's beats, the clock, the heart, the interval between the last meal and the next meal, the alternation of day and night. Trying to understand how and why writing is rhythmical, I thought about mechanical, biological, social, and cosmic rhythms, about the interplay of bodily rhythms with social regularities, about the relation of rhythm and order, rhythm and chaos. One way to start thinking about such things is to try to listen to your own body's beat. Many kinds of meditation begin, and some go on, by concentrating your awareness on breathing, nothing but breathing. You sit and you pay attention, full attention, constant attention, to your breath as it goes in your nostrils and comes out. When your attention wanders, you gently bring it back to your nose and the sensation of breathing. In, out. In, out. To sit and be fully aware of the air going in and out of your nose and nothing else, this sounds really stupid. If you haven't tried it, try it. It is really stupid. Nothing your intellect can do can help you do it. This must be why so many people for so long have used it as a way towards wisdom. Rhythm is pulsation. So is life. If they want to know if you're still alive, they feel for your pulse, no? Find your pulse where you can feel it easily and attend to it. It's evenness and irregularities. Heartbeat changes a lot. It's seldom metronomically even for long. And also attend to the interval between beats, thinking of the pulse as a boundary between intervals. Event and interval, like figure and ground, can be reversed. Walking is a lovely beat, just walking. Runners like a fast, pounding beat, a high stress rate, that's fine, but it's also pleasant to walk, just walk, in awareness of the steady, subtle, ever-changing rhythms of walking. Tai Chi walking is interestingly rhythmical. I learned to do it thus. You're barefoot. You stand still for a while. On an in-breath, lift one foot and move it forward. Set it down as you breathe out. The other foot will naturally begin to rise, but its full rise and movement forward must wait for the in-breath. It comes softly down on the out-breath. Meanwhile, the first foot is ready for the in-breath. You aren't going to get very far walking this way. I used to fall over quite a lot when I first tried it. To keep your balance, it helps to set the whole foot down at once, lightly. not striking down heel first, and to be aware of the touch of foot on ground and the touch of ground on foot. This is very low stress rate walking. It's a form of meditation because you can't think about anything else while doing it. Meditation is a word often used to mean thinking, but as I understand it, it means not thinking, which is much harder than one would think. In any case, all the meditative practices I know offer an immediate awareness of bodily and other rhythms. Rhythm in language. Stress. I apologize for the didactic tone of this section. The subject of language rhythms has a technical vocabulary, and as with all such jargon, some words need explaining. The technical word for the beat in language, spoken or written, is stress. There are unstressed languages, but English is a language that uses stress. English is a language that uses stress. Some syllables get said harder than others. That's stress. Every English word spoken by itself has at least one stressed syllable, even if it only has one. For example, when. Many words, however, when used in sentences, receive no stress. The, of, in, a, when. For example, when used in sentences. In normal speech, a stress occurs every few syllables. Note, most of us discovered as children that if you repeat any word aloud, such as the word syllable, 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 or even your own name, it will begin to sound funny and then become meaningless, having been reduced by repetition to pure sound and rhythm, which is all it really is. This is important. Poetry and prose differ in the frequency and the regularity of stresses. Frequency. In poetry, there is often only one unstressed syllable between stressed ones, and seldom more than two. Thus, tum-ta-tum, or tum-ta-ta-tum, but seldom tum-ta-ta-ta-tum. Prose often has three or even four unstressed syllables between stressed ones. In other words, in poetry, the intervals are shorter, or in other words, in prose, the intervals are longer. If you say more than four unstressed syllables in a row, you are likely to find yourself mumbling. That's what mumbling is. Syllables in a row, that's four. Syllables in an unexpected row, that's six, and it is so mumbly that in reading it aloud, we're likely to put in a substress, perhaps on the un of unexpected, to give it a bit of a beat so that it's easier to say. Both as readers and as speakers, we want the stresses to occur fairly often. We resist long intervals. We don't really like mumbling. Regularity. A regularly repeated pattern of stress slash unstress, a regular beat in language, is called meter. Meter belongs to poetry alone. Within the realm of poetry, free verse does not have meter, but the stress count of free verse is high, and it sneaks in a lot of semi-regular, sort of metrical patterns. Prose does not have meter. Prose scrupulously avoids any noticeable regularity or pattern of stresses. If prose acquires any noticeable meter for more than a sentence or two, just as if it rhymes noticeably, it stops being prose and becomes poetry. This is the only difference between prose and poetry that I have ever been certain of. Stress rhythm in poetry. Metrics. English meter in the earliest days was accentual, which means people just counted how many stresses per line. The metrical unit in such poetry is the line or the half line. Each unit has the same number of stresses, but there is no set number of syllables in the line and no set arrangement of stressed and unstressed syllables. Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf reproduces the four-stress line that breaks into two half lines. Down to the waves, then, dressed in the web of their chainmail and war shirts, the young men marched. By Chaucer's day, English poets had taken to counting syllables along with stresses and to thinking of the line as divisible into feet. Some poets still argue that you can't put English stockings onto Greek or Latin feet, but most find the concept of the metric foot a useful one. All who do agree that the foot that goes the farthest in English has two syllables, the first unstressed, the second stressed. Tatum, the I am. Tee-hee, quoth she, and clapped the window to. That line from Chaucer is iambic pentameter, five-beat iambic. English poetry has over the centuries favored this particular meter. It has been suggested that this may be because five heartbeats relate to a comfortable breathing rate, so that iambic pentameter fits nicely with the living, breathing, speaking voice. Metrical poetry has a regular pattern, yet many, many lines of poems in iambic pentameter do not actually go, tee-hee, quoth she, and clapped the window too, ta-tum, 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 ta-tum. Or, as it's usually written, a dash for the unstressed syllable, a stroke for the stressed syllable, and a slash to separate the feet. The pattern is endlessly varied by substituting feet. A tum-ta here, a ta-ta followed by a tum-tum, an unstressed syllable dropped or added. All these variant feet have names of their own, trochee, pyrrhic, spondee, anapest. The innate stresses of the words, manipulated by the syntax, play against the demand of the regular beat, setting up a syncopation, a tension between expectation and act, which is surely one of the essential ploys of art. Here are three lines of Shakespeare, who was, no question about it, good at this sort of thing. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought. If you force a pure iambic 10-syllable line pattern onto these lines, you'll get, thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought. Clearly, this won't do. Of and the are not stressable words. Besides, we aren't rocking in a rocker, we're reading poetry. The natural stress of the words within the sentence and the syntactical phrases or meaning groups they fall into are in active tension with the ideal pattern. They fit it, yet they fight it. I'd speak the lines more or less this way. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with a pale cast of thought. This puts only three stress beats in the first line with three unstressed syllables in a row. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all. The second line is regular, except for its extra final syllable. And thus, the native hue of resolution. The third uses the two-foot variation of two unstressed followed by two stressed syllables. Is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought. The poetic heart never follows the metronome. The rhythm of these lines is complex, subtle, and powerful, and that power comes from its syncopation with the ideal or underlying regular pattern. The first of these lines also demonstrates why the idea of the foot will always be problematic in English. My scanning of it above would give dash stroke, dash dash, dash stroke, dash dash, dash stroke. That is, 5 feet, iambics alternating with pyrrhics. But reading it as I would speak it aloud, I scan it into three elements or phrases that are not usefully describable as feet at all. Dash stroke, dash, dash dash stroke, dash, dash dash stroke. So I introduce here the idea of bars. When I scan either poetry or prose by reading it aloud and listening for the beats, I find it falls into short, syntactical groups, which I call bars. I mark them with a vertical slash. The intervals between bars may be very slight or even imperceptible if one is reading or speaking very fluently, but I think they exist. I think they clarify both the thought and the emotion and are as essential to the rhythm of the poetic line or sentence as stress is. But I'm not certain anybody else would agree with me, or would mark off the bars as I do, so I simply mention it and hope someone sometime who knows more about the subject will tell me what they know. The line is a vexed subject in modern poetry. Many poets argue for reading poetry aloud without any pause at all at the end of lines, but it seems to me the line is part of the pattern, the rhythm of the poem. In reading free verse, if the voice gives no indication, however slight, of the line end, the hearer cannot know where it is. This reduces the lines to mere typography. The regularity of metrical verse may signal the ear where a line ends, but it still needs some support from the voice. Speaking Shakespeare is a constant compromise between the natural run-on of the voice in dialogue and the beat of the pentameter lines that underlies it. If in search of natural tone, the actor completely ignores the lines, the poetry is being read as prose. Here's a wonderful example of what a poet can do with line, Gwendolyn Brooks's Be Real Cool. We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. And another from John Donne. At the round earth's imagined corners, blow your trumpets, angels, and arise, arise from death, you numberless infinities of souls, and to your scattered bodies go. The syntactical phrases break out of the pentameter lines, creating a strong tension. The technical name for a phrase that runs over into the next line is enjambment. It is a form of syncopation. What happens to the rhythm and to the meaning if we take the enjambments out of real cool? We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. No, I can't go on. We can also desecrate Donne's quatrain by following the syntax and abandoning the pentameter, the same words exactly, but without the rhythmic tension given by enjambment. At the round earth's imagined corners, blow your trumpets, angels, and arise, arise from death, you numberless infinities of souls, and to your scattered bodies go. Not only is the structure weakened by the loss of the emphatic rhyme pattern, but the tense, powerful beat of the lines has gone flabby. I did not desecrate Brooks and Donne only to show the power of the line in poetry, but also as an indication of why poets may seek strict, formalized patterns to work in. The observation of a pattern, even an arbitrary pattern, can give strength to words that would otherwise wander bleating like lost lambs. This is why it can be harder to write prose than to write poetry. Stress rhythms in poetry. Free verse. Free verse has no regular meter, but there are stress patterns in most free verse, just as there are often plenty of rhymes and other rhythmic devices, though not in predictable places. Finding the flexible, changing patterns in free verse is a matter of listening intently, using your own ear to catch the poet's beat. For example, in Whitman's Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking, you'll find the hypnotic, gentle beat of that title line recurring here and there, changed and varied, throughout the long poem. Tum-ta-ta-tum-ta, tum-ta-ta-tum-ta. Free verse that avoids stress patterns and doesn't use the line end as a pause may compensate by other rhythmic devices, other kinds of pattern and recurrence. One is the regular repetition of lines or parts of lines. Left to its own devices, English poetry seems to do this only in refrains, but it has imported exotic forms, such as the sestina and the pantoum, which not only set up a pattern by strict repetition, but control the range of emotion and meaning by restricting the choice of words. The ideal of free verse is that the poem itself will find slash create its own internal pattern, as unpredictable and inevitable as any fir tree, any waterfall. Stress rhythms in prose. Tentatively, I propose the following statement. There are two elements to stress rhythm in prose. First, actual syllabic stresses. Second, syntactical phrases or word groups following syntax, punctuation, sense, stress, and breath. These groups are what I call bars. By reading a passage of prose aloud, you will hear both the syllabic stresses and the slight pauses or rise and fall of intonation that break the sentence into bars. Almost certainly none of us will read or hear or scan it in the same way. That doesn't matter. Prose has a whole lot of latitude. The thing to remember is that good prose does have a stress rhythm, subtle and complex and changing though it may be. Dull prose, clunky narrative, hard-to-read textbook stuff, lacks the rhythm that catches and drives and moves the reader's body and mind and heart. There are no rules for finding and feeling the rhythm of prose. It is a gift, but it is also a learnable skill, learned by practice. Probably the best practice is reading out loud. You know how an uncomprehending reader reads out loud, a scared fourth grader stumbling and missing the beats? A poor reader can't dance to the prose. But the best reader can't make lame prose dance. The only rule of prose scansion I know is listen to what you are reading or writing as closely as you can. Listen for its beat and follow your own ear. There is no right way. The way that sounds right to you is the way. Tao rules, okay? Don't worry if you mark the stresses differently at different readings. Don't worry if others disagree. 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 With repetition and emphasis, a regular beat tends to establish itself. My last reading of that casual prose sentence with just a wee bit of elision is iambic tetrameter. We are rhythmical animals, but prose refuses to give us predictability. If in prose one sentence is an iambic tetrameter, all you can predict is that the next one won't be. True prose rhythm is always just ahead of us, elusive, running ahead, leading us on. Scanning prose, experiments in stress patterns. Prose rhythm is made up of many elements, repetitions of sound, parallels in syntax and construction, patterns of imagery, recurrences of mood. But just now I am sticking to the stress, the brute beat of it. I think that if Virginia Woolf, in the quotation that opens this book, is right, that style is all rhythm. And I think that she is right, and that, yes, she is profound, then even just the brute beat of a sentence might tell you something about what the sentence is and does. Do certain kinds of prose have certain characteristic stress rhythms? Do authors have a characteristic beat of their own? What follows are some very crude and simple investigations into the stress rhythms of some bits of prose narrative. Mostly, I just wanted to find out what would turn up if I counted the stresses. I had some expectations. I thought I might find clear, immediate differences in the stress rhythm of different types of prose, and I wondered if I would find measurable differences in the stress rhythms of different authors. What I am counting here are oral stresses. These are the rhythms of the voice, not of silent reading, which is a mysterious activity far too fleet and delicate for my coarse net. It is my strong belief, however, that all prose worth reading is worth reading aloud, and that the rhythms we catch clearly in reading aloud, we also catch unconsciously when reading in silence. As there are no rules of scansion in prose, anybody's opinion is as good as anybody else's. My method consists of reading the sentences aloud. The second or third time through, I start marking the stresses, an accent mark over stressed syllables. In many cases, you will probably disagree with where I put the stresses. I probably do too. Also, there are, alas, degrees of stress. Some are unmistakable, tum. Some are arguable, tum. Some are weak, a substress, a mere tumlet to get one through a long series of tatas. I may or may not mark these feeble ones. There are many inconsistencies. I have been over these samples many times, but have never arrived at a final judgment in many places. My mind will never be easy about some of my decisions. Anyhow, if you haven't already skipped this section, you can disagree with me by striking out my stresses and putting in your own. The selection of samples is whimsical. I picked writers whose style interested me and whose books were handy at the moment, and let my finger fall on a passage without any real selection, though I did avoid passages with back-and-forth dialogue. The Three Bears is included as an oral touchstone. Twain, Tolkien, and Woolf are here because I admire them as stylists. The textbook was chosen because it is a well-written one, not a horrible example of academic mumble. Darwin is here because I wanted some good mid-Victorian narrative. Austen because I wanted some good pre-Victorian narrative. Stein is here because I thought she'd come out wildly different from all the others, which she didn't. The pauses or subdivisions I call bars are indicated by a vertical slash. A slash means a minimal pause or a change of voice quality. A double slash indicates a longer pause. Longer pauses mostly coincide with punctuation, and indeed, punctuation is almost always a guide to phrase grouping. In marking these bars, again, my decisions were made reading aloud, not silently. In the Stein passage, punctuation is an urgent necessity. Without it, the words would fall into a mumble-jumble in which the reader would be hopelessly lost. I had no hesitation in marking the Wolf passage, which to my ear fell inevitably into its brief, melodious elements. I dithered endlessly over the Austen, finding it as hard to chop into bits as a river flowing. Every time I look at it again, I mark it differently. This scansion by bars is an even more subjective matter than stress scansion, and you may find it quite useless. To me, it serves to show visually some elements of the rhythmic structure of the prose, the triple patterning of the folktale, and sometimes a hint of metricality, the bar becoming a foot. Also, it shows visibly whether the passage uses mostly short, discrete phrases, or longer, more fluid ones, or a mixture and variety. The passages are of 100 syllables. I wanted the samples to be of the same length so I could count and compare various elements. The Three Bears, Folktale, Oral Tradition. Once upon a time, there were three bears, a great big papa bear, a middle-sized mama bear, and a little tiny wee baby bear. The three bears lived in the forest, and in their house there was a great big bed for papa bear, a middle-sized bed for mama bear, and a little tiny wee bed for the baby bear. And at the table, there was a great big chair for Papa Bear, and a middle-sized chair for Mama Bear. Sentences 3. Bars 13. Words 79. Words of one syllable, 61. Of two syllables, 15. Of three syllables, 3. Counting middle-sized as one word. If it is counted as two words, there are no words of more than two syllables. There are two series of three unstressed syllables, one broken by a bar line, a comma. There are four series of three stressed syllables. These tum-tum-tums are mostly connected with ponderous Papa Bear, while Mama and Baby Bear get a lighter beat. Stresses, 49. Mark Twain, The Notorious Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. Well, this year Smiley had rat terriers and chicken cocks and tomcats and all them kind of things, till you couldn't rest, and you couldn't fetch nothing for him to bed on, but he'd match you. He catched a frog one day and took him home and said he calculated to educate him, And so he never done nothing for 3 months but sit in his backyard and learn that frog to jump. And you bet you he did learn him, too. He'd give him a little punch. Sentences 4. Bars 19. Words 85.5. Words of one syllable, 72. Of two syllables, 11. Or 10.5. Of three syllables, 3. I count rat terriers as one word. This year and couldn't are each two one-syllable words conventionally combined in spelling, or unconventionally in the case of this year, so that the ratio of monosyllables could go even higher. Calculated is a four-syllable word cut down to 3. There are 3 series of 3 unstressed syllables, but each series is divided by a bar line, or comma or period, so mumbling is neatly avoided. There is 1 series of 3 stressed syllables. Stresses, 44. J.R.R. Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings. They now mounted their ponies and rode off silently into the evening. Darkness came down quickly as they plodded slowly downhill and up again, until at last they saw lights twinkling some distance ahead. Before them rose Bree Hill barring the way, a dark mass against misty stars, and under its western flank nestled a large village. Towards it they now hurried, desiring only to find a fire and a door between them and the night. Sentences 4 plus a paragraph break. Bars 15. Words 72. Words of one syllable, 45. Of two syllables, 24. Of three syllables, 2. Towards in Tolkien's English is one syllable, but evening, which I count as 2, might be 3. The single series of 3 unstressed syllables is divided by a bar line or comma. I mark 1 series of 3 stresses, came down quickly, which might be disputed, as might my series of 4, rose Bree Hill barring. To my ear, these phrases do not break down into lighter and heavier stresses, but insist on being read with a strong, even beat. Also questionable is my reading a dark mass against misty stars, where against is deprived of its normal stress by, to my ear, the overriding rhythm of the phrase. Stresses, 47. Virginia Woolf, Between the Acts. Then something moved in the water, her favorite fantail. The golden orph followed. Then she had a glimpse of silver. The great carp himself, who came to the surface so very seldom. They slid on, in and out, between the stalks, silver, pink, gold, splashed, streaked, pied. Ourselves, she murmured, and retrieving some glint of faith from the gray waters, hopefully, without much help from reason, she followed the fish, the speckled, streaked, and blotched, seeing in that vision beauty, power, and glory in ourselves. Sentences 6 plus a paragraph break. Bars 24. Words 75. Words of one syllable, 53. Of two syllables, 19. Of three syllables, 3. There are 2 series of 3 unstressed syllables, 1 broken by a bar line, or period. The unusual series of 7 stressed syllables with only 1 unstressed syllable in it is marked clearly to be stressed by the comma and semicolons, stalks, silver, pink, gold, splashed, streaked, pied. It probably raises the stress count in this selection higher than Woolf's norm. Stresses, 47. Craig Graham et al., The Heritage of World Civilizations. The new technology in textile manufacture vastly increased cotton production and revolutionized a major consumer industry. But the invention that, more than any other, permitted industrialization to grow on itself and to expand into one area of production after another was the steam engine. This machine provided for the first time in human history a steady and essentially unlimited source of inanimate power. Sentences 3. Bars 10. Words 52.5. Words of one syllable, 25. Of two syllables, 14.5. Of three syllables, 9. Of four syllables, 2. Of five syllables, 1. Of seven syllables, 1. There are seven series of three unstressed syllables, one divided by a bar line, and two series of four unstressed syllables. There are no series of over two stresses. Stresses, 33. Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice. It was generally evident whenever they met that he did admire her. And to her it was equally evident that Jane was yielding to the preference which she had begun to entertain for him from the first, and was in a way to be very much in love. But she considered with pleasure that it was not likely to be discovered by the world in general, since Jane united with great strength of feeling a composure of temper and a uniform cheerfulness of manner which would guard her from the suspicions of the impertinent. Sentences 1. Bars 10. Words 72. Words of one syllable, 55. Of two syllables, 9. Of three syllables, 9. I count generally as three syllables, general as two, preference as two. This may be quite wrong for the way Austen would have said the words. There are six series of three unstressed syllables, one broken by a bar line, and one series of four unstressed syllables. There are no series of more than two stresses. Note the assonance of the first four stressed syllables. Prose can get this close to rhyme without its being noticeable as anything more than a pleasantly musical quality. Stresses, 34. Charles Darwin, The Voyage of the Beagle. I hired a gaucho to accompany me on my ride to Buenos Aires, though with some difficulty, as the father of one man was afraid to let him go, and another, who seemed willing, was described to me as so fearful that I was afraid to take him, for I was told that even if he saw an ostrich at a distance, he would mistake it for an Indian and would fly like the wind away. The distance to Buenos Aires. Sentences 1. Bars 13. Words 77. Words of one syllable, 58. Of two syllables, 15. Of three syllables, 1. Of four syllables, 2. There are four series of three unstressed syllables, three series of four unstressed syllables, one broken by a bar line, comma, and one series of five unstressed syllables broken by a bar line, or comma. There are no series of more than two stresses. The delicate, humorous metricality of the final phrase, "fly like the wind away," is certainly deliberate, involving also a poetic inversion and alliteration. Stresses, 35. Gertrude Stein, My Wife Has a Cow. Have it as having, having it as happening, happening to have it as happening, having to have it as happening. Happening and have it as happening, and having to have it happen as happening, and my wife has a cow as now, my wife having a cow as now, my wife having a cow as now, and having a cow as now, and having a cow and having a cow now, my wife has a cow and now. Sentences 2. Bars 10. Words 76. Words of one syllable, 59. Of two syllables, 10. Of three syllables, seven. All the same word, happening. There are five series of three unstressed syllables and one series of four broken by a bar line or comma. There are no series of more than two stresses and only two series of two. That the stresses almost all occur singly gives the sentences a peculiar rocking gait, a fairly consistent three-foot metric beat based on happening, continues with wife has a, and is then replaced by a different beat beginning with the double stress wife having. Given these semi-regular beats, the repetition of words, the repeated rhyme cow now, and the alliteration on H, this passage is probably best regarded as possibly a poem, anyhow not exactly prose. But the stress count is much the same as in my other narrative samples. Stresses, 38. Judson Jerome, in Poetry, Premeditated Art, a useful and interesting book, says that poetry averages 40 to 60 stresses per 100 syllables, while prose averages about 20 to 40. My samples of prose run higher than that. He says that the maximum number of non-stressed syllables between stresses in poetry, on average, is 0 to 2, while in prose, it's 2 to 4, while the maximum possible number of unstressed syllables in a row is 6 to 7. I've seldom found even 4 unstressed syllables in a row occurring in good prose. Here's my count of how our prose samples vary in the number of stressed syllables and some other counts and comparisons, which I find fascinating, and you may wish to sink deep in the sea of unread statistics. Per 100-syllable sample, number of stresses, most to fewest. Three bears, wolf, 48, Tolkien, 47, Twain, 44, Stein, 38, Darwin, 35, Austin, 33, Craig, 32. Number of words, most to fewest. Twain, 85.5, Three Bears, 79, Darwin, 77, Stein, 76, Wolf, 75, Austin, Tolkien, 72, Craig, 52.5. Number of sentences, most to fewest. Wolf, 6, Twain, Tolkien, 4, Three Bears, Craig, 3, Stein, 2, Darwin, 1, Austin, 1. Number of bars, most to fewest. Wolf, 24, Twain, 19, Tolkien, 15, Three Bears, Darwin, 13, Craig, Austin, Stein, 10. Number of one-syllable words, most to fewest. Twain, 72. Three Bears, 62. Stein, 59. Darwin, 58. Austin, 55. Wolf, 53. Tolkien, 45. Craig, 25. Two-syllable words, most to fewest. Tolkien, 24. Wolf, 19. Darwin, Three Bears, Craig, 15. Twain, Stein, 10. Austin, 7. Three-syllable words, most to fewest. Austin, 10. Craig, 9. Stein, 7. Wolf, Twain, Three Bears, 3. Tolkien, 2. Darwin, 1. Words over three syllables. Three Bears, Austin, Stein, Wolf, Twain, Tolkien, 0. Darwin, 1 of four syllables. Craig, 4. Two of four syllables, one of five, one of seven. Various interesting factoids emerge. That Virginia Woolf and the Three Bears have the same stress count. That Mark Twain uses more one-syllable words than a folktale. That in even a readable textbook, more than half the words are polysyllables. That Woolf writes the shortest sentences of the lot, and Austin the longest, and so on. The samples are far too small, and the method of counting stresses too subjective for any conclusions at all to be drawn. That Jane Austen's stress count is almost the same as that of the textbook is, however, a good indication that merely counting stresses is not going to give us any solid indications of the quality, in all senses, of the prose. Nonetheless, I found it an interesting and worthwhile exercise, the simple doing of which intensified and refined my awareness of the rhythms of prose. Beyond stress. Long prose rhythms. Stress units are the smallest elements of prose rhythm and the most purely physical. The frequency of stressed syllables and the handling of the beat so that it's neither jerky nor monotonous are essential elements of the character of the prose sentence. Thus, the sentence itself, as I tried to show in my analyses of the previous passages, is a rhythmic but never regularly rhythmic element of prose. Other elements of prose rhythm are vastly longer and larger and far more elusive. Rhythm is repetition. In a prose narrative, which must move with the events it tells, what can be repeated without losing the narrative impulse? What events can recur, of course with variations, to form the long rhythmic patterns of narrative? Recurrent events in a narrative have to do with sound, the words, phrases, sentences, and they have to do with meaning, the content of the words, images, described actions, moods, themes. There is repetition, much more repetition, even in very sophisticated narrative, than one might expect. Repetition of words or phrases. Virginia Woolf's novel, Between the Acts, offers a simple, straightforward example of the repetition of a phrase throughout a long narrative. An amateur pageant is being performed outdoors with some recorded music, and the old phonograph hidden in the bushes keeps going chuff, chuff, chuff. The chuffing of the phonograph, varied slightly in the wording, recurs as a refrain throughout a whole section of the book. It seems insignificant, but it's so effective that when the phonograph stops, you miss it. In a sense, a whole new rhythm is set up by the lack of that repetition. Another kind of repetition is a characteristic phrase, a character tag. In David Copperfield, for instance, Mr. Micawber's ever-hopeful, "In case anything turns up." Having a character say the same thing often enough that you come to wait for it can be a mechanically humorous contrivance. But Dickens is not a mechanical writer, and when the Micawbers are on the brink of ruin, the repetition darkens humor into irony, sympathy, and pain. Fiction can take a trivial event or even a single word and repeat it in different contexts, changing and deepening its meaning every time, and intensifying the structure of the narrative. This is worth thinking about. In school, we got red circles on our paper for saying repetition four times in one paragraph. We're taught to avoid unintentional repetition of words or phrases, so we may have come to feel distrust or disdain for repetition as a device. But the power of deliberate repetition in a narrative is both great and legitimate. Repetition of images, actions, moods, and themes. The next essay in this book is a study of the rhythmic structures in a chapter of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. It continues the investigation of what these rhythmic structures may be and do. To sum it up very briefly, I found that many of the events and scenes, though each is vivid in particular, repeat or will be repeated by other events and images within the chapter and throughout the book, relating all the parts of the story by alluding back to or foreshadowing events, scenes, images, movements, relations, acts, responses, moods. Every part of the chapter is part of the pattern of the whole chapter, and the greater whole, the book, is immensely self-referential, largely through semi-repetition, variations on the same themes. I think this is how a well-written narrative works. Through endlessly complex rhythmic correspondences. Its coherence is established by inner references and backward-looking or forward-looking semi-repetitions. If they are pure repetitions, Adding no new vision or emotion, the story loses narrative drive. Pure repetition is better suited to ritual than to narrative. If the rhythms become predictable, the coherence of the story is mechanical. But if the repetitions vary, echoing and foreshadowing others with continuous and developing invention, the narration has the forward movement we look for in a story, while maintaining the complexity and integrity proper to a living creature or a work of art. A rhythmic integrity, a deep beat to which the whole thing moves.